Hey guys, good morning. Welcome to Storytime with Tofu. I apologize, we're a bit behind schedule this week. Just got a little bogged down with some scheduling. I'm bringing on a guest later, my good friend Nate, to talk about Fargo, since we do watch it together. And that episode should be either dropping Thursday or Friday. So we're going to do a little bit shorter format, quality themed episode today, focusing mostly on episode 5 of season 2 of The Leftovers, and then of course episode 3 of season 2 of The Nick. Now, you've already just heard, if you are watching The Leftovers, you should recognize that. That's the overarching piano theme that's literally almost in every episode of The Leftovers. They kind of overdid it in season 1, and I kind of like what they're doing in season 2, tapering it back, playing with the speed variability, and kind of being less reliant upon it to make the audience feel things. Yeah, it's shocking. You know, I love The Nick for its ability to, like, not use that type of scoring and make me feel incredible things. And it is funny that I was pretty dependent on for the first season of The Leftovers on that subtle piano scoring by Max Richter. Reichter. It's R-C-H-T-E-R. So I'm not exactly sure how to say that. But anyway, really good. And honestly, this theme is what kept me on the first season, because I did actually love it so much. It to me, perfectly perfectly encapsulates the show in, like, a one thematic score. And just like, are you feeling like this? Are you feeling like this? Where are we right now? 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 Now I've given up. Now I've given up. And then it repeats. 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 Now I am excited. Yeah. So I'm going to keep doing that in episodes, because it's way too much fun for me not to. Again, if you noticed in episode 1 or 2 of this second season, they didn't use that the thematicism in exactly that same timbre. The introduction of that theme in season 1, it almost never changes its tempo. Its dynamics don't change. Dynamic levels don't change too much. But every time it's inserted so far in the second season, it feels either incredibly lagged behind, kind of, I think, trying to remember, hey, we did this in the first season, remember this song? You should kind of start feeling that way again. Or it speeds it up. And the only really, I can't really think of a symbol that represents more, in the sense that, okay, so a big complaint of the first season was it dragged on as hell. So let's just speed up this theme and give people the idea where, hey, we're taking this at a better pace. It's supposed to feel lighter. These piano hits aren't supposed to smack you in the face every time it comes on and make you feel sad or make you feel nihilistic, because that's mostly what it made you feel. But anyway, Season 2, episode 5, we finally get our Matt episode. Matt Jameson is the ex-priest who in the first season was trying to save his church. He's the brother of Nora, who's Kevin's current love interest, the woman whose family's all departed. You know what? I'm just going to assume all of you are watching the show, so I'm not going to give as deep of a recaps into just specific characters as that. I'm sorry. But so Matt has now moved to Miracle, and it's already been announced that when he was there, his wife, Mary, woke up, and it was like she was never made a vegetable by a car accident caused by the first departure. And, you know, this episode has felt the most like season 1 so far, in the sense that it's almost, in my opinion, mirroring what Matt went through in season 1, in which he was trying to save his church, trying to get all this money, ends up being mugged, had to, like, dig up money in Kevin's backyard, and at the end of the day isn't able to save his church. And we just kind of see him crying next to his wife, who he loves dearly, and which is the only, okay, that's not the only window into this character's soul, but that is the one thing that constantly grounds him for me. I can't imagine how painful it is to just have to sit next to the woman you love and not be able to interact with her yet. And, you know, okay, talking about the whole dependency thing, that's a whole nother conversation, but that is also very sad. And it is a plot device used in a lot of movies and series to, you know, kind of show being in a funk, a depression, and the first season kind of, again, as in with a lot of the other characters, just kind of spat it in our face and said, this is his life, anguish with him, feel his pain. And, you know, it did make you think about certain things, you know, in terms of like, oh, why are we here? But it didn't give us any hope, or better yet, it didn't give our character any sense of wonder or any sense of hope. It kind of just boxed him in as this somewhat one-dimensional, he's a good guy, he's always going to do the right thing, and nothing's going to go his way. I just love how this episode 5, being the most like the first season, is a complete turnaround and kind of a self-aware realization of that character and that episode. So let's first take a step back and look at the overall themes of this entire season, okay? So we have their move to a town called Miracle. We are kind of, as Hollywood perspectives pointed out, obnoxiously assaulted by this kind of nonsensical, very like symbolic and like artistic scene of like a cavewoman giving birth and then living through life, suffering tragedy, and then dying. However, at the end of it all, you know, despite her death, her child is saved. And okay, up until that point, we hadn't seen much of the town yet, but I was under the impression that it was called Miracle. We heard that from the trailer, we heard that from the teaser, that no one in this town has disappeared. So my first thought when I watched this entire thing, mostly probably because I'm too into like period and how like period crosses bridges and generations and makes us all think about the same human condition, blah, blah, blah. But more importantly, if you notice, there's an eagle. You know, you look up to the sky, there's an eagle in this introduction. And the first thing that woman sees, she sees the eagle. We see the eagle from her point of view as she's dying in the river. And then as soon as we leave her point of view of the sky, we see a woman come in. A woman who can not save the woman who's dying, but a woman who can carry on her legacy, carry on her child. And more importantly, carry on that story, carry on a symbol, carry on a sentiment, carry on what is essentially a miracle. I mean, her child was going to die. She was stranded in a riverbed, bitten by a snake. I mean, there. Okay, so here's where you get into the greater theology of the show. Is this a miracle, or is this coincidence? Is it the same? Is it one and the same? And is coincidence and symbols just something we associate with what is a miracle? You know, you could even go back as far as to say the birth of the child was almost a miracle because her water broke and she left the cave right before an earthquake and everyone she knew and loved died in an earthquake. So, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of a study of not just religion, but mythos and theology. Why we associate ideas and symbols with power. What is miracle? What is magic? What is coincidence? And what doesn't matter? Because at the end of the day, there really isn't an answer to the question, is it a miracle or is it not? And I like to think this season is really kind of exemplifying a mix of both. You know, you get people who treat the world, you know, as its oyster. It's like, oh, saps. I'm going to create miracles. I'm going to take the power. However, there's so brought into question by the whole universe and the whole theory of this entire world that Dave Lindelof has created is like, well, is there still something going on? And the fact that those questions still aren't being answered is what makes the show incredibly good. However, the fact that they're being addressed more directly by the writers and with the storytelling is a lot more refreshing than the first season, which, again, incredibly nihilist. So we've already been set on pace for Miracle. Matt has already told us that he has experienced a miracle in Miracle. And now John Murphy is saying that there are a lot of people here that took advantage of this. There ain't no miracles in Miracle. That has been in a teaser now, and that has been said in verbatim in the show. Kevin, Justin Theroux's character, has repeated it to his wife and got the explanation of why, you know, we have to treat this place so specially. But now, I think even further brought up by this question is set up so perfectly by the intro of the episode. I'm really upset that I don't remember the name of the song, probably because I'm not well-versed in music. But it sounded kind of like a late 60s, more kind of poppy country song. But instead of seeing a grieving Matt just not understanding why he's been put in this situation, why he's been put in this life, we get this very, very chipper song, a very, very hopeful chipper Matt taking his wife through this daily routine, the same thing every day, because he believes that, you know, she's going to wake up if he does everything exactly right. And that, to me, in essence, contradicts the entire point of a miracle. You can't wait to recreate a miracle. You can't... Well, okay, that's not true. You can create a miracle, but you're lying about it. You're creating the idea of a miracle and tricking people. However, the fundamental idea of a miracle happening to you in the truest and most theological sense is is that you can't predict it. You don't know why. You can't know why. It's about faith. It's about belief. And Matt realizes that by the end of this episode, that there's a great Taoist belief, and it can't be helped. It's a very Taoist, it's a very Buddhist philosophy. The world keeps spinning. Tragedy happens. We have to acknowledge it, learn from it, but there's no use fighting it. And I kind of enjoy that because that directly contradicts, I believe, a lot of Western religion. Okay, and this is a great generalization about all of that. You know, I'm not an expert in it. This is just my opinion, my experience with it. If you have contradictions to it and want to voice them to me, please do, because I love learning things. But regardless, there's a principle. If you catch a rabbit for a man and don't show him how you did it, he's just going to assume that it'll happen again. He's going to wait there futilely forever and assume this will happen again, because that is allegedly the balance of nature. You wait, you learn, you observe, and things happen to you. For Matt, that very much became the principle. God showed him a miracle, and instead of accepting it, appreciating it, and moving on, he's dwelling on it. He wants it to happen again in the exact same way. And he he realizes by the end that that is a direct contradiction to what belief, to what faith, to what a miracle is. And I don't know, I don't think the right word is hubris. I think it's, you know, a form of covetousness, a form of, definitely a form of covetousness, in that the idea is you're never supposed to use God for selfish purposes. And although in his mind that her having a child, her waking up from this, him being her savior, is his path to happiness, redemption, faith, that's not going to work for him anymore. He's given into the idea that we can read the signs and we can associate as many signs as we want with miracles. Again, like you see that all the time in this. She, you know, the fake water in the town that they give to people, and people are just like, it's just water. You know, there's nothing to it. The contradiction of whether this whole handprint thing is real or not, you know, that he's testing it. The idea that what is really a sign and what is really not? And Matt's decided he's not going to create signs. He's not going to be a part of the narrative until he's brought back into the fold. And so this episode ends with him naked in a pillory, relieving a man. And it's his turn to repent, his turn to be there. And you can take that several different ways. I definitely took it as he's above it all. You know, being that man in the pillory puts you puts you front and center, but it also puts you above it all. You're not contradicting why you're there. You're there because you need to be there. And when you don't need to be there, you'll be dragged or taken out of it. And that's why, you know, we still don't know why the original man was up there. And he could, for all we know, have done exactly the same thing Matt did, seen someone up there and asked, why is he up there? And pose the same question, well, are you going to take his place? And Matt did. And I think that was both a giant moment for his character development in this season, mostly because he's not going to cling to his wife anymore to feel realized, to feel close to God, to feel like this is his path, this is his reward from God. He's decided he is truly going to be a servant of God and kind of a return to, I believe, more truly to his character from the first season. With a little bit of a better idea of what's going on. It's funny, Matt always seems to have a perception of what is going on, yet we're always constantly reminded that he has no idea, and that I think Kevin is supposed to be our conduit to that world. But you can't have a show with this much religious zeal and symbolism and not have a martyr. And he was already the martyr from the first season. And I think this is just very self-aware writers telling us, oh yeah, he's still the martyr for this season. And don't forget him, because you can never forget someone like that. So a really powerful episode. Again, I love it when they can just illuminate a character you kind of don't always think about throughout the series or are forgetting, and kind of weave this very interesting tale around him. I have no idea where this is going. I don't know if Mary's ever going to wake up, because the constant battle of the show is what is real, what is not, what is basically PTSD of living in this world. And so, I don't know. It's one of those things where you really want to hope she wakes up, because that means Matt didn't, like, in a loon rage, technically rape his wife who's in a coma, because there's a whole scene where, like, if your wife cannot give consent for the test, it means she can't give consent for anything else. And that also is a very heavy theme that plays upon this episode, is that he thinks she's telling him they need to get back there any means possible, however they can, and he won't accept that. And he can't accept that not everything is going to go his way. He's too good of a person. And unfortunately, in this universe, it seems like to be a good person means you have to give up everything, or you just will not win at the end of the day. But, okay, guys, that's enough on The Leftovers. That was a really, really long ramble about signs and miracles and where this is all going. But I've been incredibly impressed with this season so far. It's been not a 360, because it didn't need to make a 360, but a perfect 90-degree pivot or 180-degree turn. You know, we're still on a very similar path with similar features, but it's just so much nicer. It's still very dark, but it's kind of like a cloudy day with, I think, people on the East Coast call it sun showers. We just call it a sunny day that's cloudy, where we're surrounded by haze, because nothing will ever be clear for this series. But through the clouds are light shining down on symbols, clues, journeys, people, and kind of illuminating this what was a pitch black road in the first season to now kind of like more. I always say this in every episode, but it's giving me a greater sense of wonder than I'd had in the first season, and I think that's incredibly important going forward, because other than that, these characters aren't necessarily compelling or interesting enough for me to only want that. I need to hold on to the great idea that their destiny, this universe, is taking them somewhere, and despite constantly making them look like pawns in the greater scheme of everything, I like to think every character is going to play an incredibly important role in shaping the future of not the series, but the universe with the Earth within the series. So that being said, let's move on to the Nick. Again, episode 3, season 2. This show keeps getting better. And more importantly, the amount of social commentary just packed into an episode is just, it's kind of like astonishing. You know, in this episode, we got eugenics, we have women's health, we have religious freedom, we have class oppression. I mean, you have these, I suppose, in every episode, but they're so blatantly pronounced in this, so glaringly like, hey, I'm going to be really, really loud about these points to make you really uncomfortable by the fact that despite this being 100 years ago, all of you still think these things, or people you know think these things, people you hear on TV are saying these things, which is utterly kind of disgusting almost, but, you know, it's kind of a really pessimistic, defeatist way to look that, you know, the tools and the people change, but the sentiment will always remain the same. And this is definitely is hitting very hard onto that point. So the first of which is, I'm going to just go through the points of this episode based on like current events is the wrong word, but you know, current sentiment in the country. You know, we're always talking about gun control, but I love how every time that comes up, there's somehow an important discussion about mental health and, oh, how are we regulating these people? Oh, how are these people getting access to guns? America has some of the worst mental health care in the country. Well, it's maybe because there's so much stigma around all of these people, all these type of groups of people. This is the same conversation that is happening in this series 100 years ago, just with a slightly different vernacular. So, you know, Evan Gallinger's wife, she lost a child, and she, I don't want to use the word gone crazy, that's how they use it, or gone mad in the show. The term mad is very popular in the show for this, to describe this condition, but she's either fallen into some intense form of postpartum depression, potential bipolar disorder. We just don't know. They don't know. Freud doesn't exist yet. Keep that in mind. But more so, where season one focused very, very heavily on the self, the anguish that society burdens upon the self, this specific story seemingly is less of a burden on Evan now, and kind of more, how does she fit into society? How do these people fit into society? And you hear her sister talk about how this transition has been so hard on them. You know, we've had to lie about her condition, but we don't want her to be locked away forever. And it's like, you know, this person's family, you shouldn't have to hide someone's condition like this. And again, we are in a very more open world about this, but you're lying to my face if you tell me that having a bipolar disorder, being possibly schizophrenic, or even being on antidepressants is not still stigmatized in this country. Meaning that, not in the sense we're going to ostracize them, but you're still othering them. So essentially what this is showing is we've gone from ostracizing people and these types of conditions to still, and okay, they're ostracizing and othering them in the Nick, but we've gotten to a place where now we're just othering them. And that is important, because, you know, I feel like the other spectrum in the Nick is you ignore that these problems exist. They're a question of, quote, moral fiber and moral character, and do not plague, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That whole BS high ground that, honestly, if you, I think in a Law and Order, it was kind of thrown at the church, like, oh, mental illness is incredibly stigmatized in the Latin American community because it's incredibly stigmatized within the Catholic Church. You have issues like this, you don't see your, specifically about eating disorders, you don't see your a doctor, you don't go to a psychiatrist because it's a family matter, you go see your priest. Not saying that priests can't give good advice on this, I'm not hating on that aspect, but that is, I've been told, very much a cultural stigma, not in just a Latin American community, just in general, of in a more religious community, mental illness is not looked at, is sometimes looked at as a character issue, and it's hard to distinguish, well, what is, you know, a chemical imbalance in my brain and what is, you know, an actual, you know, well, I guess it all comes down to chemical imbalances, but you know, what can be treated, what cannot, what needs counseling and what needs medication. Again, there is no medication in this time, but it is fascinating to see a group that is still talked about in the, with similar regard, you know, brought up 100 years ago when, you know, addiction is just being studied. You know, madness is being studied. People thought, you know, disease affects the brain, so, you know, let's start removing parts of the body that, you know, this disease could be coming from, because, you know, mental illness was seen as something that could be cured, like syphilis, like, you know, the common, not the common cold, like malaria. There's a sickness, there has to be a direct cure, you know, X, you know, XYZ, not X squared plus Y minus W, you know, in parentheses, because that is the issue that is mental health care. There's no easy answer. And this is going to lead into my next point. You know, the Nick constantly plays around with the idea of society, progress, and capital, and how the three are in a constant struggle for balance, and a balance that will never happen. Progress will always outseed society, and capital will always drive the forward, will always drive progress. So think about this, right? The farther our capital takes progress, and the farther the gap is with the rest of society. That means, like we're always talking about today, the 1% is only benefiting from the best that progress has to offer. Another thing that's incredibly clear about this show, you know, we're introduced to doctors once again, and again, not to say doctors aren't high and incredibly held regard and sometimes overpaid in this country. There's still the idea that, oh, if I'm a doctor, I've entered a new echelon of society. I've entered, I'm a higher type of being. There's still an even greater sense of that in this time in 1901 when he's at, you know, the Penn State Med Reunion, and, you know, all these doctors are talking about their successful practices and how not necessarily they're forwarding medicine, you know, they're adding, their capital is adding to the progress, but how their progress is adding to their capital and how that progress is taking them higher than what the rest of society is doing. You know, they all have trophy wives. They're talking about vacationing. They even laugh at Gallinger in the sense of like, oh, are you still cutting people up at the Nick? And, you know, as much as we hate Gallinger and he wants to be a society type, there's that raw Clive Owen who wants to explore, who wants to better society in him. And I honestly hope we see a little more of that come out as this season progresses. But moving on from, you know, that, you know, discussion about mental illness, let's even focus on the idea of eugenics. You know, we joke that eugenics is gone, and thank God it is. I was lucky enough to read a eugenics study done in Hawaii in around, I think, 1912, so like 11 years after the show. Just, it's horrifying and fascinating at the same time, in the sense that people, you know, were trying to scientifically link character traits to genetics, and that, you know, we could describe the Slavs with their feverishness and darkness, or the, you know, the Negro of low wit and lacking in moral character. Like, the fact that these men are professors at universities teaching classes on these subjects is appalling and shocking. But, again, what this show does so well is that no matter how far we've progressed, society, for some reason, always lags behind. Because, I'm sorry, any idiot can go up on the stage and be incredibly racist, like Donald Trump, saying, oh, we need to build this wall to keep out all these immigrants of like low moral fiber who are all rapists and thieves and destroying this country. Again, any crazy person can say that. And, you know, for the longest time in my safe little liberal arts / growing up in Hawaii private school bubble, that, you know, those are just crazy people. Real people don't think like that. But what's scary enough is that when he says these things, you know, people tweet stuff like this. My young burgeoning 11-year-old Republican is really, really into the Trump. And all he has to say right now is, go Trump. You know, the fact that a shocking percentage of this country supports that type of thinking is, again, just kind of, the Knicks is spitting in our face. Hey, look at these intellectual people talking about this like this is actual accepted material and science. Like these are, you know, the forefathers of thought. But no, no, you can't, you can't think that way. I don't know. What hits me so hard about it, again, is that so many people still think along those lines. And, you know, I say this every episode, the Nick is doing a great job of capturing both of those perspectives. Let me see what else I wanted to talk about today. I'm going to end a little bit of kind of about the studying of the series and little gems that it's able to add here, as well as a delve into obsession, especially in terms of character development. But let me finish on, there was another very important point in terms of social commentary other than the eugenics. It's right. Women's health and immigration. You know, as we said, Sister Harriet is on trial for you know, allegedly performing abortion. She was fallen under a case of police entrapment. She was never actually caught doing an abortion, although we know she doesn't. So we see, you know, Mr. Cleary and Mrs. Robertson have hired her a very fancy lawyer still. And now we have a pretrial hearing. And, you know, we talk about, you know, objectivity, you know, on the bench and, you know, among social servants, you know, police officers, lawyers, attorneys that work for the state, as well as judges. And this judge just comes out, and the first three things he says just make him all incredibly impartial. He quotes the Bible. He quotes the Bible and then tells her that the devil has no power in this courtroom over me, Miss Sister Harriet, as your pretender in Rome does. And it's just like, our streets are flooded with Jews and Italians and all these lower beings, and it is my job to use the power of the court and my God to show who is the true power in this great nation of ours. And it's just, oh my God, I can think of 8 reasons why you should recuse yourself right now. But again, you know, we talk about religious freedom. We talk about, you know, women's health these days. These issues aren't dead. A woman can barely, okay, I'm sorry, I get really worked up about this, and it's just so frustrating to me. A woman can barely seek an abortion has so few options to seek an abortion in a majority, over 50% of states in this country. You have organizations that go out of their way to lie to women about medical services purely based on their moral belief on the subject. You now have a judge who is using this trial not to look at facts, not to look at the letter of the law, but to look at the moral character of a person. And blah, blah, blah. Trials have been doing that for centuries, I know. But the fact of the matter is, we like to think that progress brings society with it. Progress takes who we are, takes and gives us a more objective ring, because allegedly we have more information, we can talk to other people, we can not necessarily fight our base instincts, but, you know, we are supposedly evolved. We can communicate, we have a greater understanding of everything. We shouldn't be leaving things to faith, and, you know, what a lot of people, and for a lot of people, the teachings of the Bible, although solid as they are, to the letter nature of them, is a matter of faith and belief and not practicality, not an understanding of how to run society, not an understanding of, you know, of course, medicine. I'm sorry, I need to end the the women's health rant there. But the point is, again, parallels. And shockingly, nothing has made me think more about today's problems than seeing them presented in such a horrid fashion over 100 years ago. So props to that. I'm gonna end on this last little note here about obsession. It plagues every single character in this series, and it's so pronounced that it's not, you know, kind of just like a secondary, like, oh, all characters have their goals and desires. No, all of these characters are seemingly entrapped by their obsessions. You know, Dr. Edwards and Mrs. Robertson love their obsession for each other, caught up. His obsession to not feel black. It's terrible to say he's a self-loathing black person, because he's not, but he's not proud of it. He sees it as a hindrance, and he wants to prove himself, not because he's to be a black man, to prove, you know, almost he's white. And it's kind of really interesting to see, you know, a dynamic like that. But he's obsessed with that, and you know, obsession has its downfall, which is clearly the major theme of the first season. But what I'm interested to see for this season is Mrs. Robertson's obsession with the death of the health inspector. You know, Andre's I don't know why I keep saying the actor's name. You know, Dr. Edwards' obsession to being seen as an equal. Clive Owen's obsession to save the world in order to save himself. So, you know, it's kind of amazing that they've kept Clive Owen as still the most selfish person in this entire series, despite him being seemingly repentant and, like, less drug addicty. He's, like, now trying to cure syphilis to help a friend so he can feel less shitty. I mean, there's no other way to describe that. And, you know, and at this point, you know, the first season, it was definitely all arrogance, maybe 25% guilt because of, you know, his work with Jules, but it was all arrogance, all feeding his own ego, his desire to learn more, something that Dr. Edwards also has picked up upon. And it's kind of fun to, you know, when he says, oh, we couldn't run a test like this on a human subject right now. I mean, it's incredibly risky and dangerous. And Clive Owen's like, oh, we don't have that much time. She's going to die before we give her the treatment. We have to start practicing now. And it's funny because earlier, you know, Birdie is working in a lab studying the properties of adrenaline. And they're telling, oh, we need to go through very simple protocols here. You know, we test on rats, then bigger animals, then cats, then pigs and goat. And then maybe after a year, we'll try it on people. And then Andre just goes, yeah, let's get started right now. So, you know, a lot of great exploration being done here in the Nick. You know what? And I think next episode, I'll focus a little less on social commentary and more about the individual obsessions of each character. But I like to make these comparisons. Society, progress, okay? The self, obsession and the self. Those four principles very heavily intertwined in the series, both in the narrative that this world has been weaving, as well as an insight into the mindset of each individual character. They are so obsessed with what is could be seen as a selfish, you know, it's a selfless act, but for a selfish reason. And, you know, how this obsession disseminates across their lives, mostly for the worst. So, I didn't want to talk about West Virginia Baptist priests beating their daughter, because that's what happened also in this episode. But again, incredible social commentary, an incredible perspective and insight into the self, into the mind and psyche of characters on television like this, and just a perfect reflection of a perfect 1901 reflection of today. You know, hashtag the Gilded Age, hashtag what was it, the Spanish the Spanish-American War led into the, you know, war in the Philippines. This is not a great time, but it is a time where everyone in it felt like they, felt like they owned the world. So, on that note, be awesome to each other. Listen to Fargo Talk a little bit later today, and keep watching TV, guys. There's so much to be excited about. There's so much to look for out there. And there is a niche for everybody, okay? If you hate both of these shows and you just skip to this end of this podcast to hear me say that, email me. I'll find you a show that you'll like. I'll bring you on and let's talk about it. But if you're listening, again, thank you guys so much. And, you know, stay tuned for Friday Comic Book Talk. So, bye, guys. Thank you.